is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Burning questions in advance. In a world of chaos we cannot see, we turn to machines, begging on our knees. Artificial savior, when will you save us? Oh, Deus Ex Machina.
Scientists say 1.5 degrees C of warming beyond pre-industrial is a red line for preventing more climate chaos than we've already seen. But the last 12 months were 1.64 degrees C above pre-industrial. With 1.5 in the rearview mirror, why are scientists still talking about 1.5 as though it were a real target? We are about to ask a lead researcher in the field that very question. A new study confirms what we all feared. Global warming of 1.6 degrees C is the best we can hope for, and chances are not that good. Our lead author is Christoph Bertram. He is Associate Research Professor at the Center for Global Sustainability, that's at the University of Maryland. He's also a guest researcher at PIC, the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, where he worked for over a dozen years. The paper's title is Feasibility of Peak Temperature Targets in Light of Institutional Constraints. We don't find this process easy to talk about or understand. Many of us tune right out when the subject of 1.5 even comes up. We are discouraged by dozens of years of failure by the COP process, where talk is cheap and emissions keep going up. This new paper takes that on, including limitations and feasibility in the real world. From Maryland, Christoph Bertram, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Now, according to the EU Copernicus Service, the last 12 months were, quote, 1.64 degrees C above the 1850 to 1900 pre-industrial average. Christoph, why are there so many studies on 1.5 degrees of warming when it may already be in the rear view mirror?
Yeah, this is, of course, an obvious question, but the differentiation that one has to keep in mind here is that kind of last year's temperature data is not what the average temperature is referred to when we talk about targets like the 1.5 degree target. This really is adjusted for like taking the short-term variation out of the data and really using multi-year averages, because we know that the Earth climate system has these funny patterns. For example, last year was an El Niño year, and we know that these always are much higher than the average around them. So we are not yet at 1.5 degrees Celsius on average over multi-years on this planet. So kind of what we know is that we are probably between 1.2 or 1.3 degrees Celsius. So there is still some room before we will reach the 1.5 target. And then the other, of course, important thing to keep in mind is that, and we will dive into that later on for sure, that we are not only talking about kind of the peak temperature that we want to limit climate change to, but we are also talking about returning to lower levels that are safer for us to operate our societies in.
We will get into that. Now, what did your team set out to do that is new?
So to start that, kind of, we know the Paris Agreement has these targets of limiting warming to 2 degrees and making efforts to even lowering it to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And there have been multiple scenarios in the past that showed pathways to achieving these targets. But over time, there were more and more questions from policymakers, but also from civil society actors, different companies, that put into question whether or not the scenarios that kind of inform these targets are feasible. And so the first step that happened was that different research teams went out to kind of do an analysis of existing scenarios, so scenarios that had been published before, to kind of make an assessment how feasible different aspects of the transformations within these scenarios were. Nobody yet had done kind of a multi-model effort to really look at scenarios that by design take different feasibility constraints into account. And this is exactly what we did, a team of eight different global modeling teams that tried to understand what is the difference between running our models and trying to achieve lowest possible peak temperatures just with our default setup versus with a setup that by design is supposed to mirror more realistically the real-world constraints that we have across different dimensions.
Well, let me read you a short quote from the abstract of your new paper in Nature Climate Change. Our results show that the most ambitious mitigation trajectories with updated climate information still manage to limit peak warming to below 1.6 degrees C, low overshoot, with around 50% likelihood. However, feasibility constraints, especially in the institutional dimension, decrease this maximum likelihood considerably by 5 to 45%, ending that quote. Now, there is a lot to unpack there, starting with what is low overshoot, and does that presume carbon capture and storage or something like that to get back down to 1.5?
Yeah, great question. So the low overshoot is kind of a definition that has been introduced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in its 2018 special report on 1.5 degree scenarios. It's the measure of where the peak temperature lies in comparison to kind of the climate goal. So like if we have a goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees C, then we talk about low overshoot as long as the peak temperature is not higher than 1.6 degrees Celsius. And you also read that quote with the probabilities. The complicating factor is that we, of course, don't have perfect knowledge of exactly how the climate system will react to anthropogenic, so human-made emissions of greenhouse gases. And this is why kind of we have to operate with these probability levels, which of course makes it a bit more difficult to talk about. And then to your second part of the question, of course, we know in order to reduce emissions after such an overshoot, so after kind of being at more elevated levels than what our long-term target is, we will need ways to reduce the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's for sure. We know there's different approaches for doing so. One, of course, is relatively natural, and implanting more trees, but of course that is limited. And then other approaches for that involve using bioenergy together with carbon capture and storage that you refer to. Now, what is important in the context of our study is that we don't explicitly talk about this part after peak temperature. We really only wanted to look into the model results up to the point where the peak in global temperature is being reached. And that is, science is relatively clear on that, more or less at the point in time when the global emissions of CO2 from human activities reaches zero. So that is also often called net zero. But there is the different, like the complication that sometimes people talk about net zero CO2 and sometimes about net zero greenhouse gases. I won't go into the latter, but kind of, yeah, suffice to say, for our study, the important point in time is when global CO2 emissions reach zero. If in our models we introduce the representation that not all countries share the same conditions to enact meaningful climate mitigation right from the start at maximum level, but there is a differentiation across countries, we then show that this has the implication for the maximum likelihood of staying at this low overshoot level that you quoted in your question.
So how did your study account for the many places where governments are too weak or now battered by disasters to accomplish the changes needed?
Yeah, so we don't explicitly kind of represent, of course, disasters where we also, of course, don't know where exactly they occur. We only know that for different types that they are increasing in frequency and intensity. So what we do is making use of other literature that is, of course, the basic working and principle of science that you build on what other people have found out. There's different country specificities that determine the level to which environmental regulation can be implemented by countries. What we then do is using the best available data for exactly these country specificities, which of course is also kind of not in that sense accurate science, because it's more about matching attributes with kind of also past observed success in, for example, also tackling acid rain and the sulfur dioxide pollution that caused that. But we can show that we have this huge impact on the results that I just mentioned.
And what about social resistance to change? Could you include that in a study? For example, what if religious beliefs prevent changes we need for ecological survival?
Yeah, this is clearly something we did not include in the study. This is really also what I just said with the evolving frontier of science, where we now have better understanding of kind of what different types of countries can achieve, if they have institutions in place or not. But we don't have good scientific approaches to kind of determine how the social phenomena emerge when it comes to acceptability of different solutions. So that is nothing we included in the study.
The other thing I didn't see in the study is really corporate power. If ExxonMobil was a country, its budget would be 41st among all the nations and larger than Ireland. And that's just one in a great big network of corporate wealth. Can we calculate, do you think, scenarios where fossil fuel corporations either fight to help the climate or fight against helping the climate?
That's an interesting question. And definitely there is research into exactly the influence that large corporations exert, also via research funding and different ways. And again, this is also at a level that is smaller and more fine-grained than kind of what our study operates in. So kind of our study in the models, you either have countries or even groups of countries being represented in the model as one entity. So you can't distinguish between different actors within that. And so also our study can't make statements as to kind of what the implications would be. But it's for sure that kind of the role of how also we as a society overall manage to kind of manage the transition by including the legitimate concerns of everybody involved, but also by making sure that we are not kind of captured by specific interests that don't align with the broader societal interest is a key question.
And most of our emissions don't stay in the sky. They're sucked up by the ocean and by land plants. Recently, French scientist Philippe Sieyès told us on Radio EcoShock that the land sink of plants is collapsing, his word, in this shifting climate. Oceanographers know there's a limit to carbon uptake by the sea. Should we include forecasts for reduction of natural capture in a big picture model like yours?
Good, important to understand perhaps also is the different roles of different sets of models. So the processes regarding carbon dioxide from the atmosphere being also taken up by the oceans and then within the oceans being transported to deeper layers and the speeds of that, how that works. This is not represented in the types of models that our study worked with, which is really about the integration of the economic system with a reduced form of the climate system. So the only kind of interplay that there is exactly to the probability of how likely is it that our actions that we describe in these scenarios are then achieving staying below 1.6 degrees Celsius. So in that sense, implicitly in that uncertainty that we know we are faced with is also included a representation of the uncertainty, how exactly the oceans work going forward. So in that sense, we are taking it into account, but not in a kind of explicit way.
Christoph Bertram, did you use artificial intelligence or machine learning in this study?
A very short answer, no.
Okay, so in your estimates of carbon-based energy demand, what about artificial intelligence? If AI companies build all those $100 billion server farms, that might affect the feasibility of reaching our 1.5 or 1.6 goal?
Exactly, and this is the one case where basically, I mean, again, we are not explicitly introducing that because we don't have a disaggregation of energy use types that is that granular, that it kind of differentiates between like not even server farms versus other forms of use of electricity in commercial and service applications, which we of course know there's many applications. Computers are basically in both every residential building, but even more so in every commercial building in this world. There's computers and for different uses. And we do represent, of course, that all these computers require electricity to run, and they also require industry to provide the materials and so forth. So in that sense, in a reduced form, we take into account that we have all these demands. There is, of course, an uncertainty as to how will these demands evolve going forward. We kind of, there's a basic coupling in the models whereby higher income, higher affluence is coupled with higher demands. And this, of course, we can, at least for countries that are catching up, we can parameterize that based on our historical analogs from countries that already are at higher incomes. But then, of course, the frontier is where will the demands go for countries that are already very high income? And their AI plays in the current debate a big role, where people argue that we could basically, from a situation of mostly saturated demands in many service categories for high-income countries, AI could lead to that boost and much increased demand forecast. My take is that it's a bit early days to really be sure about. Is that something that also people, of course, talk about in order to kind of, because it's in their interest to kind of have people kind of invest into these things. Because, of course, in the end, if AI, I mean, the main premise of that is that it's a very efficient technology and really useful in saving resources. So, and only if it can do that, it also is kind of a commercial and economically viable alternative. So there is also a scenario where in the end, it actually never lives up to its promises, but then also the demands for it will also not skyrocket. But there is, of course, in between kind of a dystopian scenario that one can think about, where it basically keeps on growing and growing. Also, it actually never reaches basically the efficiency it kind of originally aspires to. And that indeed would make it harder. We did not look at such a high demand scenario explicitly, also because the ex-post studies on existing scenarios that I mentioned at the beginning were mostly pointing to the fact that the scenario space so far is not looking enough at scenarios that, on the contrary, we have a lower demand. Perhaps not going into the details here, but what we show is in that case, we call that the enabler. If you have lower demands in your system, the transformation becomes easier on the supply side.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Why is so much of the discussion in the paper about carbon pricing instead of other all-of-society methods to save ourselves, like carbon and energy rationing, for example?
Well, the carbon price is really not meant to imply that policies never like have to be in that form, right? I mean, we also know carbon pricing itself can take different forms. Also, I think we mentioned it explicitly in some point that, of course, countries can apply and are applying a host of different types of policies, ranging from regulation to incentive structures. And the problem, of course, is if you have multiple regions within your model and you, of course, don't know about like how future implementation of these host of detailed policies will look like. So in order to just simplify the picture, this is why our models operate with this tool of the carbon pricing, the marginal abatement cost. But that really is not to imply that this should in all circumstances be the chosen policy instrument.
Well, we see how complex this is, and many things, important factors, will always have to be left out because we just don't know enough about them. So why are you and so many other scientists trying to predict climate scenarios? What is the point?
That's a good question. And the first thing to note here is really that our scenario work is not meant to be a prediction. It is an exploration. And this is a very important differentiation. So the study we are talking about here perhaps is a bit of creating a false impression, because it only looks at one set of scenarios that is at the lower end, right? But we are like of achievable temperature targets. But that is really because this is the research question we want to answer here, how institutional constraints and other feasibility constraints impact the lower level of achievable peak temperature target. But more broadly, we really as a community and in the scientific literature look at a host of all different, widely differing scenarios. And with neither of them, we kind of attach a specific, this is the prediction and this is where the world is going. But on the other hand, we explicitly know that a key difference between the different scenarios and basically what will determine which way the world will go depends on decisions by humans. And not only, of course, we know that most impactful decisions are by policymakers that basically set the rules for everybody, but also corporations and even citizens basically have a role in that whole situation. Citizens, of course, also because they, in the end, are responsible for voting in governments in many parts of the world and thereby also have the impact on what political decisions will be taken. And what we are trying to provide is a good map whereby all the decision makers and societies can see, A, what does it take to get to a specific scenario that you want to kind of achieve, or B, just being also open to explore what are implications of different decisions. These two modes of decision support, I think, can scenarios contribute in a valuable way.
At the end of last year, you were lead author of a different study of interest to all of our listeners. The title is Ramping Up Methane Emissions Reductions in This Decade, Implications of Methane Emissions for a Near and Medium-Term Warming. Is methane in the atmosphere increasing? And do you find that we just can't achieve net zero with only controlling carbon dioxide emissions?
Yeah, this is really very complementary work in the sense that kind of over the past years, I and others have been working on this one study that we just talked about in Nature Climate Change, which is mostly talking about the relationship between the carbon budget until reaching net zero CO2 and temperature. But then this other work that you just referred to on methane is also crucially important. And of course, we do reference in the fine print in each of these publications the relative importance of the other one. It's just also the part of the scientific endeavor that you have to break it down into pieces to be able to make kind of a meaningful contribution. And only in broader assessments, basically, you take all the pieces together. So to your question on methane, we know it is increasing. We, on the methane question, are actually not yet able to fully understand the picture as well as with CO2, meaning that for some sources, we don't have too good data information on whether or not emissions are increasing or decreasing. A very important case in point is the oil and gas sector of the United States, which is kind of one of the largest emitting countries of methane, and it's the largest sector within that country. But the problem is with methane, other than with CO2, it's not only the activity that determines how many emissions I have, but it's crucially dependent on exactly how the activity is playing out. That might sound very abstract, so let me break it down to you. In a coal power plant, we know how much CO2 is produced by just knowing how many tons of coal went into the plant. If I operate an oil or gas supply chain where I have somewhere the oil that I take out of the ground and then use it in a car or kind of use the gas in homes or in power plants, I don't know how much CH4 emissions occur along the way, because that really depends a lot on how I manage the process. Because, of course, in both cases, the companies involved have an interest to minimize the CH4 emissions, because whatever CH4 is staying within the system can be sold as natural gas, which basically is CH4, methane. But nevertheless, it's never possible to perfectly make such that there is no leak whatsoever. And so this is why on the methane front, we are still somewhat earlier in the process of really understanding what the feasibility to fast reductions are. But we do know, and this is exactly what the study from last November was showing, that it's crucial. Without a fast reduction of absolute levels of CH4 emissions, we cannot achieve our most ambitious peak temperature targets. And then the question, what I think is conceptually important to understand, of course, also when you want to reach net zero greenhouse gases, that definitely involves also minimizing CH4 emissions, but you don't need to bring CH4 emissions, methane, to zero. And from what I just mentioned, it also becomes clear it basically would be impossible if that really was required. But we need to bring it to the lowest possible level, and that definitely will be kind of less than half of the methane that we are currently emitting. And yeah, another complication with methane, of course, also is that it's not only the energy system, but also a lot from the agricultural and livestock system that produces methane.
What are you working on now, Christoph?
Currently, we are working again on something complementary. This study on the feasibility of peak temperature targets was mostly operating at the global level using basically a top-down approach to better understand how countries differ in their means of bringing about rapid decarbonization. What we are now doing in the current year, where also until March next year, countries are requested by the Paris Agreement process to deliver new targets for 2035, their so-called next level of nationally determined contributions, NDCs. And in that context, we try to assess on country level what are plausible pathways and target ranges that countries can aspire to, looking at kind of also what does it take for different emission levels to be reached in sectors like the electricity sector and so forth.
From the Center for Global Sustainability at the University of Maryland, we've been speaking with scientist Christoph Bertram. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Christoph, thank you so much for sharing time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Time for climate news tidbits. Some more hopeful reporting from Charles Kennedy over at oilprice.com. Quote, "The Hague has just become the first city in the world to ban oil ads and ads for large energy-consuming industries, including air travel and cruise ships. The Hague, whose city council on Friday adopted the proposal to ban these ads from January 1, 2025, is the Netherlands Administrative Center, where the Parliament, the Supreme Court, and several major international courts are based. The city is the world's first to adopt such a ban after UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres earlier this year called on governments to ban these ads. Eric Rosten of Bloomberg cites The Lancet Planetary Health Report, September 2024, with this news that never made the news. Quote, "Human activity is imperiling 8 of the planet's critical life support systems, and 7 of them have already passed into a danger zone." And this is according to a massive review of Earth science conducted jointly by more than 60 researchers and published Wednesday in The Lancet Planetary Health. Google AI says it can turn your notes into a lively podcast, complete with 2 fake hosts. I guess I can retire now. Extreme weather to strengthen rapidly over next 2 decades, research suggests. That's from the University of Reading, September 9th. They continue, quote, "Nearly 3/4 of the global population can expect strong and rapid changes in extreme temperatures and rainfall in the next 20 years. Unless greenhouse gas emissions are cut dramatically, according to a new study. The research shows that 20% of the population of the world could face extreme weather risks if emissions are cut enough to reach the aims of the Paris Agreement, compared to 70% if limited action is taken," end quote. I may have to take the next week off due to a family health emergency. You will get a Best of Radio EcoShock special. Then it's back to new shows, I hope, marching off to the climate front, fighting without hope of victory. because we must. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for sticking with these difficult and unpleasant questions about our common future. I appreciate you listening and caring about our world. Pass it on.